Prompted by the national and local conversations about racial injustice, the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion organized the Anti-Racism Summer Series. Listen now to the first presentation on the psychology of implicit bias by Dr. Saeed Mendoza of the Department of Psychology. He serves as faculty in residence in institutional diversity and director of the Social Perception and Attitudes Lab. Mendoza discusses the differences between explicit and implicit forms of bias, how these biases operate in our social world, and steps to combat their effects. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Maya Bailey, Associate Professor of Biology.
All right. I don't want to go too awfully late because I know Saeed has an awesome program set for us today. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. Let me offer a huge welcome to all of you in this first session of the college's Anti-Racism Summer Series. And today's offering is going to be the psychology of implicit bias. The first portion of today's program is being recorded and is going to be archived for future use. The PC Anti-Racism Summer Series 2020 offers critical learning opportunities to the whole PC community on topics related to race and ethnicity, systemic racism, white supremacy, and how we can all cultivate practices that support anti-racism as an essential way of seeing, knowing, and living the spirit of Veritas. This series is presented by the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion and Campus Partners. I would like to thank all of them for making today's program happen. The program will consist of a 25 to 30 minute lecture by Dr. Mendoza, followed by a 20 minute question and answer session. You will not be able to pose your questions directly. You will be using the Q&A tool at the bottom of your screen. There's also a chat tool at the bottom of your screen. Do feel free to use chat for comments. The Q&A is specifically to pose questions that can be answered at the end of the lecture portion of the program. Again, the lecture portion is going to be recorded. The Q&A will not be. So let me introduce today's speaker. Dr. Mendoza, a PC psychology professor who is faculty in residence in the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and director of the Social Perception and Attitudes Lab, which is also called the SPA Lab, which I absolutely love. Dr. Mendoza received his BA in psychology from Rice University, where he studied stigma in the workplace, and he received his PhD from New York University, where he examined the self-regulation of implicit racial stereotypes and biases against gender norm violators, something I appreciate as a woman in STEM. After earning his PhD, he received a four-year visiting appointment at Amherst College before joining the full-time faculty at Providence College in 2014. As the principal investigator of the SPA Lab, he trains motivated undergraduates to conduct psychological research in the areas of intergroup bias. Today, Dr. Mendoza will help us understand the differences between explicit and implicit forms of bias, the underlying mechanisms that drive implicit biases, how these biases operate in our social world, and steps we can take to help combat their seemingly automatic effects. During the lecture, again, please submit your questions using the Q&A tool at the bottom of your screen, and take it away, Dr. Mendoza.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I'm going to be sharing my screen so you can see my slides, and I'll speak a little bit more about my background so we can all have a common knowledge or common set of knowledge about where I'm coming from. So as Dr. Maya Bailey indicated, I am a social psychologist, which if you're not familiar with what that field is studies, is essentially we look at why people do the things that they do and how they're affected by the social world. One of the things that I'm particularly interested in is trying to understand implicit bias. And I know that this is a really difficult topic for many people to talk about sometimes because they either feel uninformed about it or they feel that they're going to be worried about being accused as being prejudiced. And I think conversations like the ones we'll have today will help us feel more comfortable having those difficult dialogues with each other. You know, I understand that over 250 people are here today, so I really appreciate so many people who are willing to learn and try to do better in their own lives. So I like to always get started by having a discussion on certain key terms that I'll be using throughout the discussion. And one of the things that I always try to focus on is defining intergroup bias. And generally speaking, this is a term that I prefer to use over things like racism or sexism, primarily because I think those are very loaded terms that that kind of imply a certain intent behind people's actions that we are not always aware of or have privy information to. So I think this is a little bit more conducive of a term to use when we discuss issues of bias. So by definition, I think that all of us do possess bias, but I don't necessarily think that everyone is racist. I think we can engage in racist thoughts, feelings, or actions that contribute to bias, but in a way that doesn't necessarily make the person racist themselves. So as a psychologist, we're often interested in studying things at three different levels: an affective level, a behavioral level, and a cognitive level. And so when it comes to the term into group bias, what it's being comprised of are affective feelings that we may have towards people. And that term that we use is prejudice. So the negative responses that we have based on their group membership is more of an affective response that we refer to as prejudice. At the behavioral level, when we have negative actions being directed towards other people based on their group membership, that's what we're referring to as discrimination. And then thirdly, the cognitive component of intergroup bias are the beliefs that we have about people and certain traits that they may or may not possess, and those are what we call stereotypes. And one of the really key things to understand is that the beliefs that stereotypes endorse are not necessarily things that we personally have to believe in, but rather that our society can hold to be true, supposedly, of different groups. So in that respect, even if we disagree with the stereotype, many of us are often aware of what that stereotype actually is about certain groups and can still be affected by them. And so I'm going to be focusing a lot of our conversation today on the aspect of stereotypes, because it tends to operate at a much more implicit level. And it's something that I also study a lot in my own research. One of the things that I want to point out, though, is that even though all these terms are separate entities or separate concepts that can operate differently, they are interrelated, right? So simply because if you have an institutional form of discrimination, for instance, such as slavery, you can imagine that it becomes easier for people to be forming negative feelings towards stigmatized groups or start to form negative stereotypes that justify those systems that are in place that discriminate against them. Similarly, if you have a negative affective response towards a person based on how they look, then it would be easier for you to discriminate against them and have negative beliefs about their abilities. So these are interrelated terms, and they often are operating in concert with each other. But many times we can separate the stereotypical information that we possess from a social standpoint from the personal feelings that we have towards particular groups. So even if we don't personally believe these things to be true, we can still be affected by them. The other aspect that I want to focus on, I mentioned that stereotypes tend to be operating at a more implicit level. And so in that respect, it's important for us to distinguish between explicit and implicit biases. Explicit bias is something that is consciously detectable and something that can be intentionally expressed and easily reported, right? So these are feelings people may have that they're consciously aware of. And if the situation's right, then they might feel free to express these kinds of biases.
I'm so sorry. Could you share your slides?
Oh, I am sharing the slides. Am I not?
No.
Oh, well then, should I start over? I shared my screen, I thought. I'll try it one more time. Oh my goodness.
There we go.
There we are. I'm sorry about that. All right, that's the first and only technical difficulty we'll have. Thank you for pointing that out. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. So as I was saying, intergroup bias is something that operates at three levels: the cognitive level, the affective level, and the behavioral level. And these terms are working together to create intergroup bias. And what I was going to focus on today would be the aspects of stereotypes, because they operate more implicitly. And so one of the things that I want to bring up is that the difference between explicit and implicit biases. Explicit biases are those that can be consciously detected and intentionally expressed. And so in many ways, they're kind of easy to spot, right? So for instance, we might come to think about very explicit segregated laws or hate groups coming together. Recently, we might think about the shootings in the church shootings in Charleston. And unfortunately, we know that college campuses are not necessarily immune to these hate crimes either. So somewhat recently, there was a noose that was draped over the statue of James Meredith at Ole Miss. We've heard about the noose that was hanging in a NASCAR stall. And also, unfortunately, this past week, PC was targeted with some hate crimes as well, with the swastikas that were spray painted on our campus cemetery. So one thing to point out is that even though these are still prevalent, one thing that we generally find in the literature is that most people are disavowing these beliefs and these kinds of actions, right? Most people stand up against them. And so if you ask, for example, whether people are opposed to school segregation or interracial marriage laws, you'll find that as time has gone on, people generally support having Black and white students go to the same schools. They also tend to support interracial marriages and oppose laws that would restrict interracial marriages. So over, let's say, the civil rights era, things have gotten much more egalitarian in our society, at least based on the explicit aspects of what people are reporting. What this data suggests, though, is that either people's attitudes are truly changing to be more egalitarian-minded, or it simply could mean that our social norms have changed where those kinds of things make it harder to express, right? That there are more penalties associated with being explicitly biased. So psychologists may wonder whether some of these biases have simply gone more underground. And that's what implicit bias tends to focus on, right? So implicit biases are things that are much harder to detect at a conscious level. And they are also things that are often unexpressed unintentionally and more spontaneously. And so unfortunately, this is much more increasingly pervasive, again, perhaps because norms make it difficult for people to express explicit biases and make it safer under certain circumstances to express more subtle versions of it. Now, one of the difficult things that we're faced with, though, is that if it's operating at an unconscious level and people may not know that they're expressing it, there's a lot of questions about how does it operate, who is engaging in these kinds of things, why does it happen? And that's what the focus of today's conversation will be. And I think if you can kind of conceptualize implicit bias as a lens, an invisible lens that we use throughout our daily life that's operating at a, you know, on a regular basis that we don't necessarily know is there, it filters how we see the world, right? And so I want you to think about that metaphor as we go through the rest of this lecture. The thing that drives implicit bias are stereotypes. And stereotypes are these cognitive, well-learned associations that have been automated over time, right? So something that you learn as a kid and continually to see reinforced over and over again in the media or through conversations that your parents have can cause things that are initially new to become much more automatic. And so the way the brain works is that oftentimes it will try to operate at a much more efficient level by categorizing information. And some of that information that gets categorized are social groups or people. Right, so for any particular social group that we might encounter, we have certain traits, some of which are negative about them and some of which are positive about them. And how we view this overall group may depend on the valence of those traits as well as how many of those traits are present, right? So in this particular example that I have on the slide right now, you may find that it's more or less balanced. And so that balance might create a generally neutral response towards the social group. But unfortunately, there are groups in our society that are much more negatively stigmatized, such that there may be more negative traits linked to that group. And not only are there more negative traits, but those traits might be much more strong than the positive ones, right? So that's being reflected by the dark blue thicker lines showing that there's a stronger association between one particular group and the negative traits than there are of the positive traits associated with that particular group. And so what happens is that when we encounter these groups at an automatic level, these traits get triggered and they can bias our thoughts or behavior without our conscious awareness or intent. I want to take a step back and explain why implicit biases become problematic and how they are essentially forming, right? And so now that I've defined these terms, I think we'll be better off understanding the following path diagram that I've created for this conversation today. Group formation is something that is generally natural. It's something that's evolutionarily adaptive, right? That we're trying to maximize our chances of survival, that we also have psychological needs to belong, and that being part of a group allows us to fulfill those psychological needs. And what can happen is that through group formation, inevitably, we're going to start to favor people who belong to our group, right? And because group formation is something that cannot be expressed at a large level, in other words, it's easier to have reciprocal trust with a smaller group of people, we start to favor certain people more than others. And through that in-group favoritism process, what happens is that we might start to differentiate between us and them. And so in-group favoritism may often lead to the formation of stereotypes to justify how your group is different than another group. And in extreme cases, it may also create out-group hate, right? And so both of these paths then create the possibility for implicit biases to form about individuals, institutional forms of bias. So if you have a situation where you're favoring group over a particular group over and over again and providing them with more and more resources, then that allows them to create hierarchies in a way that becomes institutionalized. And then out-group hate leads to explicit biases. And so once these three are operating together, what happens is that inevitably there's going to be social inequalities, right? Implicit bias will reinforce the institutional biases that have been created as well as the explicit ones, and that leads to social inequality. There are two other psychological processes that I want to mention. One is social system justification, and the other one is social dominance. System justification is a psychological process by which we engage in justifying the systems that are in place. And so people who are in power are motivated to believe that the systems that are in place are fair because it would make them feel better about being in positions of power. But unfortunately, people who are in low status groups are also inclined to justify the systems that are in place because it gives them hope that someday things could change. And if they think that the world is fair, they might be able to then rise up and have social mobility. And so that in that respect, system justification allows for social inequalities to be justified at an implicit level, which then reinforces the institutional biases and kind of creates a loop on this left-hand side. Other individuals have very strong feelings about hierarchies and believe that certain groups should be in power and that certain groups should not be in power. And therefore, they have a sense that social dominance is a natural thing. And in that respect, the social dominance feelings that people may possess reinforce the inequalities through a very explicit process and again continue to reinforce the institutional forms of biases. And I think where we're at this point in our society today is that people are becoming aware that we have a bit of a loop that we're stuck in, right? That there's a loop that is set up to not fail very easily. And we're trying to figure out in what ways are we unconsciously contributing to this loop? When in what ways can we fight more explicit aspects of the system to make the system more fair for other individuals who have been traditionally and institutionally discriminated against over long periods of time? And so I think that there's a lot of great momentum that allows us to try to understand how implicit biases and explicit biases both feed into institutional bias, and people are motivated to try to break some of the social inequality patterns that we've seen. So what I'm going to be talking about next is that I have a short kind of model to think about what are the steps that we take to try and stop implicit bias, right? If we feel that we don't possess those explicit biases ourselves and we don't believe in social dominance and we don't believe that we have negative feelings towards particular groups, what are the things that we can do on our end to be focusing more on the implicit ways in which we reinforce the system? And so this AIM model that I want to talk about today has three basic steps. The first is acknowledging that we have the ability to be biased, that we possess these biases ourselves, and that this is a stage of reflection, right? You have to think about the ways in which the things that you've been doing or saying have been subtly been biased, not necessarily by your own doing, but perhaps by being a passive member of society. We have to learn to identify what biases look like. And so in this respect, is a bit of a learning stage, right? If we've never heard of this stuff before, how are we supposed to recognize it when we face it? And then the last stage would be the motivation part, right? And so in that respect, we want to learn and make plans about how we're going to go about changing our behavior. And I think that this is a continuous model whereby even after we follow through with our plans, we know that we're not always going to succeed, right? There's a never-ending journey towards egalitarianism. And so our planning stage would then allow us to go back to our reflection stage and acknowledge the things that we're doing well, and perhaps acknowledge the parts where we're not making as much progress as we'd like to be doing, and then find out where else do we have to learn, what are the gaps, and then continue to work on ourselves in that respect. So I'm going to start with the first step and talk about how we go about acknowledging bias. And perhaps one of the easiest way to do so is the way psychologists study implicit biases through an implicit association test. I know that some of my former students are present in the conversation today. And so certainly I know that in my classroom, they've been asked to take these tests. And some of you may have also heard of the IAT. And if you haven't, we'll provide you with the resource at the end of the lecture so you can go and test some of these tests out yourself. The way the implicit association test works is that it's a dual categorization task on the computer where you'll be asked to hit one of two different keys to categorize certain information. On certain types of trials, you may be asked to categorize white faces or bad words with the left key and black faces and good words with the right key. And then after you've done a few trials of that, they'll switch it on you so that you're categorizing black and bad together and white and good together. So on this particular slide, the stereotype compatible trials are these because we're often raised in society that discriminates against blackness and has more positive association with whiteness. And these would be the incompatible trials. And so what we find is that, you know, we've had hundreds of studies that have been used on the IET before, that 75 to 80% of white Americans show a white good, black bad bias, right? And so that can be a difficult number to try to, you know, accept. And I think that in many ways, if you don't know how to interpret this data, it can be very threatening. And so I'm here to tell you a little bit more about what this bias actually may be reflecting rather than some sort of hidden prejudice that the computer is accusing you of having. So some people interpret the IET as reflecting or having tapped into some sort of true attitude that you were hiding and trying to keep away from people, right? And if you think about that, then that suggests that if your feedback tells you that you have some sort of strong or automatic preference towards a particular group that you don't necessarily agree with, then you're perhaps being accused of being prejudiced yourself. And that kind of feedback would be something that could be very threatening, right? And if we know that when people are under threat, they have a fight or flight response, the fight response might be that they get very defensive about this accusation, right? They start spouting all the reasons for why this test is wrong, why it's rigged, why it's set up to cause them to fail, and why they're not prejudiced themselves, right? Or they may flee and be embarrassed by this information and choose to avoid or confront the issue of bias itself, right? Rather than try to learn about why this feedback might have come back the way that it had, they just avoid the topic altogether. And so I don't think that this is necessarily the best way to motivate people to change, right? What I would suggest instead is that we think about it as a computer program that allows us to tap into stereotypic associations. And as I mentioned before, stereotypic associations are not necessarily ones you endorse, but they can be things that you're simply aware of. And so in that respect, if you do come back with feedback saying that you're biased, perhaps that's telling you that your culture or your society is having a really strong effect on the things that come to mind quickly, right? And so in that respect, if that bias is present, it may be motivating you to then figure out, well, how do I break that pattern, right? How do I stop those that awareness of stereotypes from affecting my personal behavior and decision-making? And that's what we're trying to figure out as psychologists, right? So I want you to think of this feedback, if you choose to take the IET yourself, as something that it can be a motivating learning process rather than a threatening attack on your personal character. So what I want to talk about next is the ways in which implicit biases operate at behavioral level, the way they come, they affect our expectations, our evaluations, and finally our perceptions. When we look at literature that looks at microaggressions, this is a term that many of you are starting to become familiar with because it's become a very popular term to use. And microaggressions are subtle statements or actions that on the surface don't seem to be offensive perhaps, but they convey an underlying hostile derogatory message. Right? So for example, some people will say that they are colorblind, right? That they don't see race at all and they think that everyone's the same. And I'll talk about why this particular statement is problematic. Or some people deny the fact that they're racist or that they're biased, right? They say, well, I can't be racist, I have a black friend. And I think you're just taking this out of context and you're being way too sensitive about what I just said, right? Or people espouse beliefs that we do live in a fair and just world and that if things are not working out for particular individuals, that they just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and try harder, right? And so a lot of these messages, again, on the surface may not seem as offensive to others who are part of the majority group, but as a minority member, what these kinds of conversations can do is they can invalidate your identity, right? So if you're telling me that we're all the same, you're telling me that we live through the same social world, which we know that, for instance, the way that institutionalized discrimination affects people of color more so, it's not a reality, right? It may also dismiss their victimization and also diminish their lived experiences, right? And so everyone has their own social world through which they view their personal lives. And we can't go around dismissing other people's experiences when we haven't been able to put ourselves in their shoes at all, right? And so, again, even though on the surface, some of these statements may seem like no big deal, and you might encourage students who have experienced them to brush it off. You know, if you imagine having these kinds of microaggressions expressed towards you on a daily basis over and over again, it can feel like death by a thousand little cuts. Even if you're careful about the things that you're saying, we can also find that people will have behavioral ways in which biases get expressed, right? So, for instance, interracial interactions tend to be things that people generally avoid, and they find them uncomfortable. And so one of the things that we find in literature is that implicit biases tend to leak out through our nonverbal behaviors. So white individuals who are in these interactions, for instance, tend to fidget a lot, they blink, they avoid people, their partner's eye gaze, they seat further away, they close their body off in orientation, they experience signs of physiological distress. So even if verbally they seem to be comfortable in the situation, their body language is telling a different story. And unfortunately, African-Americans who are in these conversations with these individuals tend to focus on the nonverbal cues, and they don't focus so much on what's verbally being said, and they can experience and feel the discomfort that's happening from the other person. And so one important thing to keep in mind is that it's not that these individuals who are white and showing these visible signs of distress or prejudice. A lot of times this is actually being driven from the concern that they're going to come across as prejudiced. And so ironically, you have so much concern about that your body language starts to backfire and starts to show signs that you are actually uncomfortable with your partner. And so what happens is that both of these individuals feel exhausted afterwards. One, the white group might feel exhausted because they feel like they've had to control too much over the conversation. And the black group may feel uncomfortable because they feel like nonverbally it was a really difficult interaction for them to go through. Stereotypes can also affect our expectations. So the way we think others will then perhaps create self-fulfilling prophecies. If you don't know what a self-fulfilling prophecy is, you have an interaction that we can imagine between a white individual and a black individual. And if there are stereotypes that exist about African Americans in our country, it might create a certain filter by which they are expecting this interaction to occur, right? And so there could be an expectation of hostility or aggression from this person. And in that respect, they're going to treat them in a very defensive or provocative way, right? And in that respect, the target in this case, even though they didn't have any negative expectations at all, might reciprocate some of that hostility. And then the person, in this case, the perceiver, would come away feeling justified in what they initially thought, right? You've created a situation where you made the person uncomfortable and had them respond in an equally negative way that you triggered in the first place, right? And so you can imagine that, you know, in this day and age, we're hearing about a lot of police shootings happening, and that if there are stereotypes that exist about people of color or maybe people who live in certain neighborhoods, that officers may have a different filter by which they go into these situations versus that they were interacting with someone who might have been white or someone who might have been encountered in a more prestigious neighborhood, right? And so these expectations can create a situation that gets out of hand very quickly. Sometimes we find ourselves being thrown off by the interaction that we have because people violate the expectations that we have about them, right? So maybe you thought someone was going to be a certain way, and in fact, they did not end up being that way. And so what happens in this case is we often engage in subtyping or creating exceptions to the rule. So for instance, this person might encounter a group of individuals who all belong to the same racial group. And they encounter one person initially, but from the get-go, they think they're all going to be the same. Then one person happens to violate the stereotype and show them that in fact they're not quite like everyone else that they thought were going to be like based on their stereotypes. Instead of thinking that there's more variability in this group, all they end up doing is refence the group and create an exception for this person. So for instance, all Latinos are the same except for this person. This is an educated Latino, so he's actually kind of a different person, a different breed, right? And then you meet another person and then you refence again. Oh, well, this person is different because of X, Y, and Z things. This person doesn't have an accent, so he's not really an immigrant, right? And so rather than changing your mind about how the whole group may be and what different abilities may exist within this group, you continue to make subtypes and create exceptions to the rule that allow you to reinforce the overall stereotype of that particular group. In my own research, we also look at how stereotypes affect our evaluations of people. And what it can do is that we can actually create double standards by which we judge others, right? So for example, if you're considering applying for a particular job and you submit your resume, they're going to be evaluating the resume based on a variety of different credentials relative to someone else. But if you happen to come from a group that's negatively stereotyped, you might have to stand out even more on paper, right? And so those individuals not only have to be competent, but they have to be extra competent, and they also have to be likable. And in fact, there's literature showing, for instance, that because academia is such a primarily white occupation, right, the majority of professors on college campuses are white, that the minority faculty members that do exist at these campuses often have a greater likelihood of coming from Ivy League schools or highly prestigious schools. In other words, the people that do end up getting pushed through and hired in academia, if they're a faculty of color, they often have to have extremely impressive credentials in a way that isn't always true for white faculty members. Not only that, you also find that names themselves can trigger the stereotype, right? So even if you're consciously aware that these biases exist, if you come across two resumes that are exactly the same, as we can do in experimental research, the name that has a stereotypically African-American name ends up being seen as unqualified for particular jobs, right? And so in our research, we find that John Smith maybe get hired over Jamal Smith because of a perceived lack of fit, that there are certain jobs that are more high status, and high status is associated with whiteness. And so we push through the resumes that fit the job better. And even if we can't pinpoint or verbalize why we think John is a better candidate than Jamal, it happens. And it's not until afterwards that we recognize in our experimental settings that the resumes could actually were exactly the same, and it was simply the name that triggered your perceived fit for the candidacy. Lastly, I want to talk about how stereotypes affect what we see and what we don't see. And so in my research, I do a lot of studies on the shooter task paradigm. And to walk you through it, it's essentially set up as a video game that tries to mimic the situations that police officers are in. And so in the video game, you see a fixation point and then a series of real life images. And on the last image, a target becomes superimposed who's holding a gun or an object. And you have a short time window to respond as to whether you should shoot or not shoot the target. And what we find is that when you give people less than a second to make that decision, people are much faster to shoot the armed black versus the white targets. And they're more likely to incorrectly shoot the unarmed target versus the black, incorrectly shoot the unarmed black target versus the white target, essentially mimicking what we're seeing in real life, right? And so a lot of these studies are being conducted on very egalitarian-minded individuals, people who espouse very positive beliefs about social groups like African-Americans, and yet they're still susceptible to these biases, right? And so one of the fascinating things about this research paradigm is that the magnitude of the size of the shooter bias, right, the frequency with which you're engaging this bias is actually best predicted not necessarily by your own personal attitudes or your own personal endorsements of stereotypes, but rather simply knowing about the stereotypes themselves. And so when we look at things like police shootings, it's difficult to say that it's just a few bad apples because the literature just doesn't speak to that. The literature really suggests that everyone's susceptible to these biases, because there's a systemic, bias that exists against African-Americans and other minorities of color regarding crime, right? And so if we have these stereotypes that get automatically activated and we don't have a lot of time to make a decision and it's a life or death situation, we shoot first and think second, right? So I know we're coming up on our time here, so I'm gonna wrap up. There are two ways that I think we can be motivated to change, and the easiest in some capacity is to simply seek out intergroup contact, seek out a contact with people who are different from you. And it's most effective under certain conditions, right? So those conditions that have to exist are you have to have interactions with people of equal status. And one of the challenging parts about this is that you might be working in a work setting where you're the manager and you have employees who are beneath you, and therefore the status isn't quite equal. You have to have personal interaction with them, right? So it can be, oh, I know I have a friend of a friend who happens to be a minority member, so I sort of know the person. You should have a cooperative goal, something that you're working towards together. And finally, you have to have institutional support. And this means that your society, whether it's your culture on campus, whether it's your culture at an organization, or whether it's the country's values, have to support the need for people to come together and get along, right? And so because these conditions can be really difficult to meet in real life, one of the nice things that we're seeing in newer literature is that simply imagining contact can go a long way in promoting people's interest and behavioral intentions to want to interact with other people that are different from them. And in fact, I have a student, Alex Baker, who's working on her research this summer, looking at what are the limits of imagined contact? Can we use imagined contact to get people to overcome their fear of people who are different from them and actually get them to be more interested and willing to engage with people who are different from them? We also need to be mindful of the goals that we're taking into these situations. So oftentimes people think that colorblindness should be the thing that we're striving for, or that we should avoid being prejudiced. And even though on the surface this might make sense, the literature doesn't bear that out. So avoiding prejudice would be, I'm going to go into a situation and not use stereotypes. I'm not going to make any biased comments when I interact with this person. I'm not going to talk about race at all when I interact with this individual. And the more you try to stop yourself from doing certain things, the more likely it is that these things will come back, right? So if I ask you to not think about a white bear for the next 5 minutes, I guarantee that that white bear is going to come up within a minute in your mind. And part of that is because of an ironic process that happens psychologically, where you have to constantly check in on yourself to see if you've achieved your goal, right? And so the more you do that, inevitably that white bear is going to pop up. And so people inevitably will start thinking more about stereotypes the more they try to suppress them. Instead, what we need to try to shoot for is engaging in multiculturalism and recognizing the benefits that come from people's uniqueness and trying to approach egalitarianism. And the way we do that is by focusing at the task at hand, so trying to be accurate in your evaluations of candidates, right? Try to not be influenced by people's identities, but rather their credentials. Be engaging. So we mentioned how body language can be closed off when you're interacting in interracial interactions. But if you open yourself up physically, it can actually create a certain level of comfort that allows people to have a smoother interaction. And be open to talk about difficult topics, right? It's understandable that sometimes majority members feel like they're worried about saying the wrong thing, or that they don't feel informed enough to have a conversation about these things. But if you don't have the conversation in the first place, you're never going to learn new things, right? So we have to be open to making mistakes, and we have to be open to being taught new things by other people who know more on this topic. So what I want to do is wrap up here by talking about the fact that implicit biases are important to learn about because they can make people feel unequal, they can make them feel unwanted, unimportant, and eventually helpless and hopeless. And I think that if we can acknowledge that implicit bias is something that we all possess, it can help us reduce its expression and stop its continuation. So with that, I want to thank you all for coming to this lecture. I look forward to answering your questions. And I also want to thank my undergraduates who work in the Social Perception and Attitudes Lab, who helped me conduct a lot of this research. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Bailey so we can answer some of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mendoza. What an awesome lecture. I've actually heard part of this before, but each time there's so much more that I take in. So thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome.
We've had a lot of great questions, and I want to let people know that if we don't get to your questions, we will try to follow up after the program today and try to address everything that we can't get to in our little Q&A right here. So I'm going to start us off with our first question that I noticed as you were talking, and that is, what are some examples and effects of what's called positive stereotypes, and how do you think they affect people subject to them?
Well, I don't necessarily believe in a stereotype that is positive, but I understand that the question is referring to things like African Americans being athletic or Asian Americans being good at math, right? And so the reason I don't believe they're positive is that people who belong to those groups, so people who belong to African American, the African American community or the Asian community, they have to have a certain standard that they're also expected to live up to, right? And it can be really stressful. If you are an Asian student who struggles with math, what would it be like for you to feel? I mean, no one wants to not do well in a particular academic setting, but if you have a group that you're now expected to really have a high standard for, I think that pressure to have to live up to a stereotype that you never bought into yourself or never don't have the natural ability in, but that in itself can create a lot of mental stress, right? So if you're a Black student who's not particularly athletic or isn't interested in basketball, if you're an Asian student who is not necessarily interested in math, if you're a female student who doesn't see herself as that communal, right, or just isn't interested in getting married, right, there's expectations that people have about others that on the surface seem positive are still unfair expectations that we hold on to other people to live up to, and then we penalize them when they don't, right? And so I think the drawback to positive stereotypes is also, and this is another thing I want to say, is that in our society, complementary stereotypes are often working in a way to reinforce the negative ones. So for instance, minority groups will be almost given certain traits that we think, oh, well, sure, African-Americans are not good at school, but they're really athletic, right? But then if we think about athleticism, how many paths to success are there in athleticism, right? That trait isn't as valuable as being academically oriented or being naturally intelligent. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's a positive stereotypes, and there's literature on this for whoever asked it. I can send them an article that speaks to how positive stereotypes work to justify the systems that are in place. And so if you have this idea that certain groups are good at certain things and not so good at other things, it still works in a way that helps reinforce the status quo.
Mm-hmm. I can really see that a lot in misogyny, right? Vive la différence.
Yeah.
The female genius kind of response.
And I think also to your point of being, what it means to be masculine as a man results in a lot of negative behaviors, right? I think masculinity is seen as a positive trait for men, but then it results in a lot of biases against women because they think they have to live up to what it means to be a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'm going to move on to our next question. Here's how it's written. A lot of these processes seem to happen without much consciousness about them, people acting individually and in groups in ways that they think are normal. How do we make them more visible or conscious at a systems level? So can institutions address implicit bias and how?
Yes, I do think that systems can recognize them and replace them. I think going back to the issue of people justifying the systems that are in place, it's the issue of motivation, right? The people who are in power are not motivated to change the system if it benefits them. And the issue with systemic bias or systemic racism is that it's not that it's comprised of racists, right? If you have zero racists in a systemic racist society, the system is still set up to be racist against certain people. So until there's more representation of different individuals in government, in law, in academia, where decisions are really being made, I think it's difficult for those changes to happen. You know, if you look at the Fortune 500 companies that make a lot, that bring in a lot of the money that drives a lot of our economy, there's about 1-3% of managers or CEOs that are people of color, right? If you look at academia, about 80% of academia is white. If you look at government, you have a very small percentage of Black, Latino, Asian representatives, Congress people, very few women who are making those decisions. And so representation matters in a way that allows decision-making to happen at a systemic level. And until we can get more of that in those kinds of institutional level occupations, it becomes difficult to do so, right? But if you have unequal schooling based on tax funding, for instance, then certain communities don't have the same access to colleges and don't have the same access and opportunities to be educated in these kinds of positions that take a lot of education sometimes to achieve, right? And so that is where the systemic bias happens. It happens early on, where it prevents representation to rise up the ranks in a way that is problematic. And this also speaks to the issue of gender bias in STEM, as you were mentioning earlier, Dr. Bailey.
Right.
Women actually earn a majority of PhD degrees in our country, but then when they get to being hired for assistant professorships or higher up, they get, they disappear very quickly.
Yeah. Thank you. It's helpful to think about how implicit bias can look at a systems level. Yeah. So the next question I'm actually going to combine with another question that I think is kind of similar. In the first person asks, would you agree that these many reactions have become habits? And if so, would you agree that habits can be broken or replaced with better ones? And another person asks, I think in a very similar kind of way, what's your advice for dealing with discomfort, right? Feeling it, but stepping back from that fight flight kind of instinct.
So the first question, I do think these have been, they've become habituated, right? That's the automaticity of it. And I think that when we are thinking about how to attack implicit biases, I actually don't believe that we have to target the associations directly as a first attack. I do think we have to try to change behavior and through changes in behavior will come to change our way of thinking. So I'll give you an example of that. When schools became desegregated, that was something that a lot of people didn't believe in the South, for instance. But they were forced to then go into school with people who were different from them. And through those behavioral changes that happened at a legal level, people came to recognize that, in fact, Black students were not that different from them, right? That they shared a lot of things in common, that they were just as capable of succeeding in the academic setting as they were. So I think what's more important is to try to get people's behavior to change. And through changing behavior, then we're going to start seeing less evidence of these biases in a way that will ultimately come to change some of the negative associations that we possess. Right? And what remind me what the second question was?
It was about how to deal with discomfort when you are thinking about it on a kind of personal behavior kind of level.
I think that is such an individual question because there are certain people who can handle discomfort more than others, right? So awkward silences is something that in and of itself can cause someone to be uncomfortable. And I think that you have to have a certain amount of security in your own identity to be able to call someone out on something they might have said that was hurtful, right? And I don't think that, again, using the term racist or sexist is helpful sometimes, like, even if it is exactly what it, there it is, you know, even if that's the exact term that should describe what they're saying, if you actually want to have them think about what they said and why it was hurtful, I do think we have to kind of take a step back sometimes and take the bigger lead. And it's unfair to ask people that, right? It's unfair to have the victim or the target of discrimination be the one who turns things around in a softer way. But I think it can be oftentimes a more productive way to say, you know, question them, you know, why is it that you said that, right? So I'll give you a personal example. I was born in Mexico, and not many people necessarily know that. And oftentimes people don't believe me because they think, well, you don't have an accent or you don't look like a Mexican person, right? And that's, you know, they somehow assume that they know what all Mexican people look like or that all immigrants, you know, end up doing the exact same types of jobs. And so obviously to me, that's a racist comment, but I generally tend to think, turn the question back around to them and ask them, you know, what made you think that or what made you say that? And they start to get really uncomfortable having to defend some of those comments themselves. And so that discomfort that you're experiencing can be turned around in a way that gets them to hopefully reflect more on why they said something. Because a lot of times people are saying things without recognizing what they're actually conveying, right?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I want to be thoughtful about time. So I'm going to move on to the next question, which is specifically when we think about anti-Black racism, how should people who identify as people of color but not as Black or African-American engage with the notion of their own racial biases, which they are subject to and also participate in? Is there research on this that is different, that different communities of color can use to inform addressing anti-Black racism?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of the conversation that we have in our society is focused on anti-Blackness for two reasons. One, and I will say that my lecture today focused on anti-Blackness because a lot of the psychological literature does focus on Black-white interactions. And the reason for that is historically, we have a country that has been, you know, discriminating against a particular group for such a long period of time that it is somehow unique or different than discrimination that other groups might also experience themselves in a way that shouldn't invalidate their own experiences or forms of discrimination. But I think there's a variety of different reasons for why I think Blackness is a specifically, Blackness is something that's discriminated against and biased against all over the world, right? So if you look at countries like Mexico or countries like Asia, dark skin in general is seen as a negative, low status symbol. That lighter skin is seen as a positive, you know. And I think biblically, you know, there are stories about Black being bad or dangerous or evil, and white being good. So I think that conversation is unique in that respect, and that's why there's a lot of focus on anti-Blackness specifically. In terms of how other communities of color, I mean, we certainly know that communities of color are equally targeted by the police. Actually, the rates of Native Americans being killed by the police is much higher, disproportionately higher than it is for Blacks, Latinos. So there are a lot of communities that are getting, perhaps feeling overlooked, and maybe feel like, where is their voice in this conversation? And, you know, I don't have an answer to how do you balance your own identity as a person of color who is not necessarily Black per se. You know, I see them as complementary processes, that the systems that are in place are often interchangeably replacing groups. So I think right now the conversation is about anti-Blackness, but a couple of, you know, years ago it was about anti-immigrants and specifically anti-Mexicans, right? Anti-Latinos. And so the conversation changes to some extent in terms of who the targeted group is. And I think we want to be mindful of that in terms of making sure people's voices are not being left behind. But I do think that there's uniqueness to Blackness, and there's differences in a way that people of color who are not Black or African American should still feel like they can communicate how their experiences are similar or unique.
Awesome. We have a couple more questions that I'm hoping to get to. There are a lot of questions that are in the Q&A that are awesome that I don't think that we're going to have time to get to, but we will try to follow up in some way after this program. But I didn't want people to start signing off before they realize that there's a survey you can fill out with feedback. This is our first in a series, and we really want to hear how this came off for people. So I've put that into the chat. So there's a link there. Please fill it out while it's fresh in your mind. We know that people, when they fill out surveys, and Dr. Mendoza will back this up as a social scientist, right? Do it now, because you won't remember later. And we really do need that feedback.
Yes, please.
So, having said that, can you provide a specific example of the AIM planning process?
A specific example of that. I was trying to provide examples of it in my lecture. Let me come back to that one. Let me think more about that one. Maybe I can answer that one offline just so I can get more context as to what they're looking for, because I think maybe I need a little bit more information on that.
I think this last question is very pertinent because it asks about schools, and here we are at Providence College, and our Providence College community is who's turning in here. Do schools bear responsibility in facilitating interactions between diverse populations in order to improve relationships and minimize negative stereotypes?
The short answer is yes. And I think the challenge that we're facing at PC and, you know, institutions across the country, not just PC, this is not unique at all to PC, but PC is a primarily white institution and has been since its existence. You know, we're generally are trying to be mindful and better at diversifying the campus numerically and representation-wise. And I think that is a good, important step. But I think the inclusion part is where we struggle with, and I think many college campuses struggle with inclusion. And oftentimes people don't understand that inclusion involves two different things. It involves a sense of belongingness and a sense of uniqueness. And so sometimes I think that, for example, we might sell people on the being part of the Friar family in a way that conveys belongingness, right? That you are belonging to this group as soon as you're on a step onto campus, and people can buy into that message and feel good about that. But the second part is where sometimes it's more challenging to figure out how do you have a sense of uniqueness that's being respected, right? Mm-hmm. That you can be part of the Friar family, but you don't have to look a certain way, or you don't have to dress a certain way or sound a certain way. And I think representation in the classroom in terms of the things that you're reading can go a long way in doing that, right? Having different historical perspectives being talked about in class, having diversity in the reading list that you're given in your English classes, or even in, you know, the science classes, I make sure that I have women represented as authors on the science papers that they read, or show them photos of minorities who are scientists as well, right? To give students the opportunity to feel that their identity as a minority member, whatever that minority label is grounded in, belongs in this academic setting, right? That this is a place where you, even if you had traditionally not been expected to be at, you are here, and we need to change the narrative about everyone being here in a way that's unique to their own experience, but also bringing them together as part of a larger community the way that we do with the Friar family.
Nice. So we've got like maybe four more minutes. So I'm going to keep throwing questions at you as long as we are before the hour, but I want to be respectful of everybody's time. One person asks, for those of us who are hiring managers or serve on hiring committees, what specific actions can we take to counteract implicit bias in the search and hiring process?
Well, there's a couple of different things. One, you know, I think evaluating resumes blindly is something that can be difficult to do at that level in terms of trying to make sure that people's candidacies are examined on their own. But there are ways to do it, right? You could assign every application a number in a way that early on in the process, you are only making decisions based on their credentials. And so as you get further up, it'll be harder to disidentify individuals. But I think once you get to that second level or third level, if you find that your pool doesn't have any form of diversity, and diversity doesn't have to be diversity in terms of color, right? I think sometimes people define it as very race oriented, but diversity in terms of gender, diversity in terms of disabilities, diversity in terms of language abilities, right? There's a lot of different ways in which diversity benefits the workplace. And I can give to this individual a long list of readings that show those benefits. I think early on in the process, people make cuts very quickly on, again, the perceived fit, right? And whether that's the background that they had, academic background or their work experience, sometimes we perceive those differently. So if someone takes, for example, a gap year between now and between college and their next job, does that get perceived the same way if it's coming from a person who is not traditionally in that field, right? Do we see it as an opportunity for growth, or do we see it as someone who just wasn't that motivated to succeed in that particular path? I think those kinds of stereotypes can kick in early on. So if we can disidentify some of those applications early on in the process, it might allow you to pull out some of the strongest candidates, and then you can take a step back and see, is this pool representative of the people who we should be able to hire from? And if it is, then you can probably feel okay about moving on to the next step. Or if diversity becomes really important to you in your workplace, figure out a way to go back to the pool and see what you might have missed.
I know that in the past, there's been some great consultation here at Providence College with our diversity office about how to write job ads that really center what diversity can bring to those positions. And so helps us kind of identify what we're really looking for.
And I do think those job ads, the language that are used can be very gendered sometimes. So okay. I know there's research showing that, you know, women will be turned off from certain applications because they're worded in a way that appeals more to men, right? So I think you're right that early on in the process, you can tap into some of those things. And I think you also, as a hiring committee, need to be on the same page about whether you are looking for diversity as a strength. Like sometimes people don't think it matters, so then they don't put it into their formula. And if you're explicit about it in the first place, then I think it helps them really think about the benefits that they could, this person can bring into their workplace.
Definitely. Well, I think that's the end of it for today. There were many great questions. We will try again to address them later. We will also be sending to all participants access to the information and further learning that you can do. Obviously, being an anti-racist is a practice. It's something you have to continue doing. All of us have to keep going. And so we're giving you further homework. Don't think that this is the end of it. And you'll be hearing more about further programs in our anti-racism series this summer. Thank you, Dr. Mendoza. Thank you, Nick, who was our technical help. And we'll be closing out this meeting. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Providence College Podcast. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, YouTube, and even on your smart speaker. Please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Or if you have any feedback for us, email us at podcast@providence.edu.